My. Good morning. Today I'm reading from the English Standard Version, the book of John, chapter 19, verse 16. Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him, and the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. They came up to him saying, "Hail, King of Jews," and struck him with their hands. Pilate went out again and said to them, "See, I'm bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him." So Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns in a purple robe. Pilate said to him, "Behold, the man." When the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die, because he's made himself the Son of God." When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. He entered his headquarters again and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. So Pilate said to him, "You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." From then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out, and he sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement, and in Aramaic, Gabbatha. Now it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, "Behold your king." They cried out, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So he delivered him over to them to be crucified. So they took Jesus. And this is the word of the Lord. Thank you. Thank you.
If this is your first time here today, welcome. And also know that I appear a bit discombobulated. I normally do not preach in a robe or in shorts or in Crocs. You have come in a very special day, not because I am in a robe or in shorts or in Crocs, but because you have come on a day where two individuals made in God's image, given a will to choose which way they shall go, have decided to follow Jesus. And in keeping with that decision to follow Jesus, they intend on entering the waters of baptism today, which marks their allegiance to him over all that they could lay claim to as an alternative. When anyone makes such a decision, they are taking part in something very ancient, something that Christians have been taking part in for 2,000 years now, when they have decided to follow Jesus, to follow him into the waters of baptism, to commit themselves to listen and obey him, to trust Jesus ultimately as their only safe harbor, their only refuge, their only hope for the present and for the future. So they take part in something very ancient, but it's actually more ancient than that. Since the creation of humankind, there has been a question that has come before every single generation. I don't mean a question asked by every generation. Doubtless, all generations share in asking certain similar questions. Questions like, what is the meaning of life? Or why are we all here? Where did this all come from? Where is it all going? What happens after we die? Who is God? We have many such questions, but my interest today is not in the many questions we ask, but in the one question that is forever posed to us while we remain on this earth. It was the question first asked of our first parents, of Adam and Eve, and it has been asked in every generation subsequent. And the question is this: who will you follow? Now, some astute Bible students here will say, but Pastor, God didn't ask them that at all. I've read Genesis 1 through 3. That wasn't his first question. Technically, you are right, of course. God isn't recorded asking Adam or Eve anything until they had already betrayed his trust. And his first question to Adam was, where are you? The question was asked to Adam because he held the position of relative authority among equals. But apparently both were off the path, which, had they remained on, would make God's asking the question completely unnecessary, because he would know exactly where they are, where they were supposed to be all along, following him. Prior to that literal question that God had asked them, God had issued a command, don't eat from this particular tree, that begged another question. The question, will you follow me? Just think about this for a second with me. Each of you have different levels of authority over others. Maybe you feel like you don't, but you likely do in some sphere of life, have some place, even among equals, where there's some type of hierarchy, a first among equals. Think of any place where you issue a command. Two things, at least two things, there's more that happens, I'm sure, but at least two things I'd point out happens when you issue any type of command. First, you demonstrate your relative authority. This is why it is so offensive to parents' ears when their children demand things as if they are entitled to them. Give me a treat now. Rather than entreat their parents as those in authority over them for their good. May I please have a cookie, Dad? In fact, I was punched in the leg just this morning because I did not give out such a cookie. And no, it wasn't Hannah. Because, as you probably know, I would not dare standing between my beloved and hers. But secondly, so that's the first thing, we express authority when we give a command. But secondly, in giving a command, even where you have legitimate authority, you are at the same time appealing to someone else's personal autonomy. Their will over themselves, you could call it their self-governance. And you are urging them to follow you. So when I tell my children tonight, as I do most nights, unless their behavior earlier in the day rules it out entirely, when I tell them tonight to finish their dinner, if they want their cookie, I am telling them the way, and it's a good way, but ultimately they must choose it. Unless you are physically forcing someone to do something or to go somewhere, what you do when you issue a command is you place a fork in the road for them. And you urge them which way to choose. But naturally, the question arises in our minds. as people with our own wills and our own wants and our own ways of thinking about things. And that question is, which way will I go? Who will I follow? The stakes are, of course, raised when the one issuing the command is in a greater place of authority. How much greater are the stakes raised when the one issuing that command is God? And he tells you which way to go. In my house, I may have authority over the cookies and other such things. And yet Scripture tells me that God owns the cattle and presumably the cookies as well on 1,000 hills. He's got authority over everything. So when he issues his command, and regardless of what the command is, at the same time the question is being asked, will you follow me? And if we will not follow the Lord in whatever command he issues, the question remains, well, who will we follow then? If it feels like we are a long way off from what was just read to you from Pilate, the Jewish leadership, this trial of Jesus, I assure you we are not far off at all. I would remind you who were here last week and try to catch you up a bit, those who weren't. The last scene before this one, it closed with two interactions. One was between Pilate and Jesus, the other between Pilate and the Jewish leaders. In each case, there was a fork placed in the road from the one in authority, and each party had to decide which way they would go, who they would follow. The conversation between Pilate and the Jews covered both politics and religion, but it ultimately narrowed to one choice that Pilate presented them. You want to choose the way of Jesus? Radical religious leader. Or would you have me release Barabbas, a radical, violent revolutionary? And the conversation between Jesus and Pilate, that conversation centered on kings and their kingdoms and where their kingdoms are from, but it ultimately narrowed to a question about ultimate truth, and Jesus claimed to be the bearer and the witness of ultimate truth. He went so far as saying, all who are for the truth come to him. They listen to his voice. What was happening there, it was subtle, but Jesus was placing a fork in the road for none other than Pilate. Revealing again in a subtle way that Jesus had authority even over everything in this situation. And we are reminded of that again in what was read. When Pilate wanted to assert his authority over Jesus, Jesus said, no, 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 please understand. You would have no authority over me whatsoever. You have a legitimate authority, but that is an authority which has been bestowed upon you from above. Meanwhile, that's where Jesus is from above. So Jesus was placing a fork in the road for Pilate. Pilate had detected this, Jesus turning the tables on him earlier in the conversation, when Jesus had asked, in response to being asked about being the king of the Jews, Jesus said to Pilate, do you say this of yourself, or did someone else put the idea in your mouth? Pilate didn't love the question. It was as though Jesus was presenting Pilate with the same type of decision tree he had been presenting to everyone else he had ministered to on the earth, where Jesus would say things and do things, and then ultimately he would say, who do you say that I am? He would reveal himself, who he was and where he was from, but then he would put the onus upon them, who do you say that I am? He was willing to do this even with his closest disciples, but who do you say that I am? When Pilate had recognized the direction of that conversation, he disdainfully put distance between himself and the Jews who Jesus was apparently putting him in the same company with. and had been his primary focus of ministry. Pilate had responded, chapter 18, verse 35, "Am I a Jew? Then Jesus put the question, that fork in the road, in terms that Pilate was a little bit more apt to consider, in terms of truth, in verse 37. I'll read it, especially for the benefit of those who weren't here last week or maybe haven't heard this before. The question seemed to keep turning on Jesus being a king, which Jesus did not run from, but then he was elevating something beyond, something more pressing. Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world." He is not running from the claim to be king, but there's something on the other end of it. "To bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." When Pilate heard that, he put distance again, casting doubt on whether such truth could even be found, could even be known, and simply asked without allowing an answer, "What is truth?" And yet, in Pilate's continued hesitancy, which we see repeated throughout chapter 19, just over and over again, Pilate going back and forth, waffling between the Jews and Jesus, the Jews and Jesus. And in each case, after he speaks with Jesus, he seems to be leaning towards Jesus. But ultimately, he keeps making decisions that are for the Jews. And so he has Jesus flogged. It's spoken of so briefly in the verse here that it almost seems unimportant. "Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him." Chapter 19, verse 1. It's a very quick sentence, isn't it? Could just sound like, "And then the father swatted the child's hand." But it was much more intense than that. It was very difficult this week doing my reading, not because what often is difficult about doing a lot of the reading, preparing. Sometimes, it might shock you, but some of the reading is boring. Sometimes the reading is a bit technical and is a lot to wade through, and all the different ideas that people have about what the text means. It's a bit much, but it's part of the job. And I like it, but it can be tiresome. But that's not why it was difficult this week. This week it was difficult because every time I read anything historical about the realities of crucifixion and what preceded it, anytime I read anything about the scourging and the flogging that Jesus endured, it was just jarring. What Jesus was exposed to, you know, part of me wondered when I watched the movie, maybe several of you have seen it, Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ. I wondered when watching that movie how much of the scenes of the torture and of the scourging and the flogging, how much of it was exaggerated. But then I read the historical accounts of similar floggings and scourgings that generally preceded crucifixion, and it was nothing less than brutal. If you're pretty familiar with the Old Testament, you might be familiar with the idea of the 39 lashings or the 40 lashings minus one. That was a punishment given out by the Jews to ensure that someone would not die. So they would get 40 lashings minus one. But when Rome would carry out a similar flogging, there was no number. You could go as far as you wanted. In fact, even when the sentence of death was not given, when the sentence was only some type of level of beating, and there were three broad levels of beating, an initial level that was mostly serving as embarrassment but still painful and involved some type of whips. And then there was a middle level that was significantly more severe. And then there was a final level that it seemed, whenever it was employed, prior to the judgment of death. And it so weakened the person's body that once they were crucified, it would speed up the process. Whatever the case here and wherever it stands, that the general consensus, especially with the eventual verdict that's rendered, crucifixion, it is, I think, rightly presumed that the most harsh torture, whether it's at this point that's initially talked about or there was a secondary flogging, maybe there was an initial lighter beating rendered to hope that the crowd would release its anger, release its determination to have Jesus crucified. That's revealed in a general way here by Pilate bringing Jesus before them after already enduring it and encouraging them to release him. That's shown in Luke very clearly when it actually says that Pilate's motivation for having Jesus flogged was so that they might release him, but it did not work. Whatever the case here, the beating that Jesus received was horrific. The whips that were used, and I want to be careful because there are children, but the whips that were used had shards of metal and or bone in them to make sure that they did not pass easily through the skin. This was absolutely brutal. It often left its victims with things exposed which should never be exposed, like part of one's bones. So this is absolutely brutal, what Jesus suffered. But we see Pilate, even though he's willing to have Jesus go through that, and we might scratch our heads, what type of justice system is this? But even if Jesus ultimately, in Pilate's eyes, okay, even if Jesus ultimately is not convicted of being the so-called king of the Jews and this rival king, this rebel king, even if he's not regarded as someone who is truly treasonous against Rome, which is an automatic de facto death sentence, he still would recognize that Jesus is stirring trouble, that he's stirring dissent, he's causing trouble, he's a troublemaker. So in one sense, from Rome's perspective, it doesn't even matter. It doesn't matter how good Jesus is, how honest he's been, how many nice things he's done, all the miracles he's performed, how honest he is, how truthful he is. It doesn't matter. He's causing trouble. There is more at stake for Rome than what is true. And we see this in a number of ways in the passage. We see that Pilate is starting and increasingly to recognize the truth, at least some truth about Jesus, at least bare minimum. Pilate is recognizing the lie that the Jewish leadership have hoisted upon Jesus. He is recognizing that, and he is not convinced of their case. We see that in the clearest way in Pilate's own words before the Jewish leaders. Pilate's initial assessment of Jesus was what? Chapter 18, verse 38. This was his initial assessment of Jesus after the whole conversation about truth and what is truth and all of that. Pilate walked away from that, approached the Jewish leadership, and he said, "I find no guilt in him." Literally, it's like he's saying in the original, "You've got no case. You've got nothing here." He's not saying, "I've found your case lacking. It's a little soft in certain areas. People have raised objections." It's just, "You've got no case. What you've claimed is not true." This is encouraging to the reader at first, as we think about Pilate and how he's relating to Jesus. We begin to wonder if the truth was starting to get at him. Even though Pilate had said, "What is truth?" We begin to wonder, is the truth starting to scratch at Pilate's conscience? It's not just that Pilate rendered him innocent once, at least in regards to the charge. Every time that Pilate returned to speak to Jesus, he walked away more convinced of Jesus' innocence regarding those claims. Every time. And so in chapter 19, verse 4, the words are repeated in a follow-up conversation. This is after Jesus is brutally beaten. "See, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no guilt in him." And after that's rebuffed and rejected, they plead for Jesus to be crucified. Pilate says in verse 6 again, "Take him yourselves and crucify him." And he knows that they can't do that. But he's trying to send a message. "You take him yourself and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." Isn't this encouraging? Even the world recognizes that there's something truer about Jesus than those who are coming against Jesus. I think the world still admits this in so many ways. Every time the world says Jesus is a good teacher, really, he was killed for blasphemy. But he was a good teacher, wasn't he? It's hard to avoid it. For Pilate, it's hard to avoid the truth. But truth isn't the only factor. Truth is not the only variable in a world fallen as ours. It's not the only factor in our own decision trees. Last week I talked about the convenience of lies. Without even giving applications of that, you know exactly what I mean. All the places where we know what's right, we know what's true, we know what's wrong, we know what's false. And yet we go here. Again, we know what's true. We know what's right. But we choose what's false. We choose what's wrong. Which tells us there is more at play than a simple question about what is true. The ultimate question is, who will you follow? As a simple matter of following the evidence, the verdict should have been very clear. Jesus should have been released. Pilate had said 3 times. Scripture uses that type of mechanism to depict a fullness, a completeness. It's the same that's used of Peter's denials. How many times did Peter deny Christ? 3 times. There was a fullness of his denial. And when Peter was eventually restored by Jesus after his resurrection, how many times was he restored? 3 times. There was a fullness of it. So here, Peter is given a fullness of his verdict. He's innocent. He's innocent. You've got no case. And yet, as we so often see in our world, truth is not the only variable. It is not the only compass we employ to navigate life. And sadly, justice is not the only priority, even in the justice system, theirs and ours. There are questions like, what is expedient? What's practical? What's easiest? What will appease? What will please? What will serve my interests? What will suit my needs? What will make me happy? What would make my wife happy? What would make my dad proud? What would my friends say? If I said I was following Jesus and I'm going to get baptized this Sunday, what would it mean for my career prospects if I decided to share the name of Jesus more often? Such concerns proved pivotal in Pilate's decision over Jesus. Pilate was was showing himself to know more and more of the truth. But the truth is not what he chose. This sends, there are so many important applications to share from this. Maybe chief among them is this. You know, Pilate, as compared to the Jewish leaders, who just will not even consider Jesus' claims. For all that they've seen Jesus do, for all that they've seen him say, for all of the ways that they have not been able to counter his logic, counter his scriptural interpretation, counter him on the streets, counter him in private, they haven't had an answer for him. For all of that, for all of the truth he revealed, for all of the good that he did, they had warded themselves off from that. The truth was no longer the leading factor. But Pilate here, we might be encouraged that he's embracing more of the truth. He's coming closer. He's getting an understanding. There's more hesitancy. But where does he go? Who does he follow? Ultimately, in this passage, we saw in the other passages, things delve down to a question about Barabbas. But here, the question is different. The question is one of supreme concern. It's who is the king? And which king will you align yourself with? Because Jesus has not run away from being a king. He hasn't claimed to be a political king like Rome's king, like the Caesar. But he has not denied being a king. In this text, over and again, we see that the option, it's not between Jesus and a multitude of other options. Here it's Jesus and Caesar. Even the Jews, in their fervor to cast Jesus off, were ready to embrace, even if it was hypocritical and insincere and they didn't really mean it. They were ready to say, "We have no king but Caesar." These are the people with the calling of God as made God's chosen people. They were uniquely blessed to have God as their king. But now they had gone so far along the line of preferring what the world would offer in the form of a king, that when the real king comes, the real and the true king of the Jews, their preference would be for Caesar. And then Pilate, when it's his decision, he joins with them. Maybe it's more expedient, it's more practical, it suits his interests, his needs, his wants. But it does not serve the truth. And there is a steep cost for living in a lie. There is a steep cost for embracing a lie. Our first parents proved the great difficulty, Adam and Eve, we all have in placing our trust in God. Yet God has been asking humanity all the way along, in various forms, in various commands, in various instances, and now after the cross. He has been asking us all along, will you follow me? And when he's asking us that question, we should consider the alternative and where that alternative leads. Jesus would remind us of his authority and that he has not only authority over all this world, but he's got authority over the next. Who will you follow? I would remind you of one piece of evidence when you make that decision. Two people are about to be baptized who have made that decision on who to follow. But I believe for them, I know for myself, and I would hope for each of you, that decision, which has proved difficult for all of humanity, whenever it has been asked, who will you follow and will you follow me, when asked from God, as difficult as that question has always been and remains to be, That question is much easier for us to answer in the affirmative, to say, yes, I will follow you, God. Yes, I will trust you, Jesus. Yes, you are the way and the truth and the life. It becomes much easier when we see what that God was willing to do to gain our trust, to gain our allegiance, to gain our entry into his kingdom. We trust people for a myriad of reasons. They're powerful, they're influential, they have influence, they have money, they have say, they have access to an easy button. We, for a myriad of reasons, we follow different people. When we follow Jesus, we follow someone who pushed no easy button, who used none of his influence, who used none of his power to escape his situation, but he humbled himself even to death on a cross, that we might gain entrance into his kingdom. Consider all the people you have followed and all the people you might follow. And consider again, will you not consider following Jesus, who gave his life up for us all? He gave all of the things up that appeal to our flesh, the power and the money and the fame and the influence. He gave that all up, having it all, and gave himself over unto death, that we might have life in him. Follow him. I don't have the authority, I suppose, to command you to do that, to urge you to follow him, but he does, and his command is clear. Jesus said, you believe the Father, believe me also, follow me. He said it over and again, follow me. And he's saying it, not me. He's opening the door for you again this morning if you haven't. He's saying, follow me. What else do you have to choose? What else do you have to go on? How long is that going to last? What are the dividends of that investment? Look where I would go for you, and follow me where I go. Trust me over her. Trust me over him. Trust me over them. Can you even trust yourself? God says, I am the one you should trust, and the proof is in the cross. Follow me. He is the king over all. But he will not force any of you into his kingdom. He has made the way. He is the way. I would urge you, along with those who will give their testimony, their embodied testimony, by following Jesus in the waters of baptism, to do likewise. Sometimes we need to learn from children. Many times children need to learn from us, and it's our job to teach them. Today is a day that you ought to let them teach you. They have chosen the right thing. Joshua said, choose this day whom you will serve. As for me and my household, we will choose the Lord. That's Tripp's decision. That's Joran's decision. So let's get it over with. Tripp and Joran, would you join me?